loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big issues. First, House Republicans unveiled their tax plan today. What does it mean for the people? What does it mean for corporate America? What are its chances of actually passing? Then former DNC chairperson Donna Brazile published a shocking article in Politico slamming the Clinton campaign, Barack Obama, her predecessor Deborah Wasserman Schultz, and more. What's behind this surprise move? And next, in a speech today in New York City, Attorney General Jeff Sessions exploited the grief and anger caused by Tuesday's terrorist attack to push for mass surveillance and restrictions on travel and immigration. But first, we turn to the issue of taxes and the Republican Party's tax plan. House Republicans unveiled their tax plan today, which slashes the tax rate for corporations alongside many other measures. But this is just the first step in a long and treacherous series of negotiations that could derail their push for tax reform. We are joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. And from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Welcome back, Daniel and Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Hi.
Daniel Sankey, the Republicans are obviously really wanting to succeed somewhere. And this somewhere, of course, would be for their base, meaning their very, very rich constituents and for corporations and for banks, possibly a big deal. What does the House plan show you? Of course, not all the details are out yet.
Yeah, what it shows me is that the fight is heating up. And the different interests within the Republican Party and elsewhere are starting to come into conflict with one another. So what you see in the tax plan is some of the similar stuff that you expected. So, for example, a drop in the corporate tax rate to 20%, which is a significant decrease from 35%. But then you also see these kind of contentious items like 401ks. Now they're backing off and saying, oh, no, we're not going to change those. And they're also backing off on mortgage interest rate deductions for people who already have a home, though they're decreasing it somewhat for people who may have a home in the future, and also doing similar things with property taxes. So what you're seeing is them dialing back, backing off some of those really contentious issues a little bit. And it's going to be quite a fight, though. I think there's still a lot of interest. The National Real Estate Group was saying, this is what we feared, that this would happen. We're going to fight back against this. And so it's definitely going to be a fight. It'll be hard to see how it'll shake out in the end, but they're already dialing back some of the more controversial and hot button items.
It seems that this is really not tax reform so much as it's a tax cut. A lot of these proposals have sunsets attached to them. So they're only going to be around for a year or two or five or 10. And then they go back to their original numbers. At the same time, I think you're exactly right, Daniel, that we're seeing a real split already among Republican-associated pressure groups. The National Association of Home Builders already said that they don't like any of this. They don't like any changes at all to the home mortgage deduction. They think that it's going to slow home building, and it's going to discourage young people from purchasing a home. So my question actually is to Dave Lindorf. What do you think is going to happen inside the Republican caucus here, where you've got anti-tax militants in the Tea Party that are going to have to go to battle now on the floor of the House and in committees against moderate Republicans who want some kind of a compromise measure?
Well, that's going to be a big problem for Republicans because they're cutting taxes, yes, but they're raising taxes on when I analyze it, I've done it, it just got announced and I was just looking through it, but it looks to me like they're going to wind up hitting a lot of the people who are the mainstay of Republican voters, particularly in swing districts. I'm thinking of, for instance, my own, which is a sort of a 50-50 Republican Democratic suburban area, fairly well off, not me, but most of the area.
You're not representing your demographic.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, for instance, you know, a lot of Republican voters are fairly well-off people who have a conservative bent and want to keep their money. And when you start hitting the mortgage deduction and putting a limit on it, these are the people that really benefit from that. You know, lower income people don't even get to use, they don't usually have enough of those taxes to pay that they can use what's called the Schedule A deduction form, and so they can't take the deduction. And unless you have a lot of deductions, you don't get to have the advantage of that, either medical deductions or these state and local tax deductions plus property tax deductions. But when you start putting a cap on it, it's the people with the $500,000 or $1 million house who want the mortgage deduction on it, and they're going to get slammed. So, and those are the Republicans. So I think there's going to be a lot of pushback from suburban district Congress people who are Republican.
I think that's probably right. You know, this is going to, just like the repeal of Obamacare or attempts to repeal Obamacare would have hurt people in red states far more than in blue states. I think you're exactly right that this is going to hurt wealthier people who are more likely to vote Republican than it will Democrats.
Like middle class people.
It's good for the really rich,
right?
But it's screwing the sort of people who consider themselves middle class, but who are actually sort of low-level rich people.
That's right.
Yeah, it's good for the top 1%, but not for the next 19%.
You're exactly right. That's what it comes down to. And we haven't even discussed the notion, the Republican notion, of doing away with the deduction for state and local taxes. That's going to hurt middle class people.
That's a blue state one because you're going to hit places like New York and California and Pennsylvania and places that have fairly significant, and you know, especially if you live in a city like, you know, Philadelphia, New York City, these are cities that have most large cities have significant local tax rates, and that's a big deduction for the middle class. And if they take that away, they're going to, and you know, a lot of Republican Congress people come from, say, red state cities that have income taxes. So you're going to see, there's in a lot of places that you wouldn't expect, maybe you're going to have resistance.
Yeah. And the blue states, while, you know, of course, they have a Democratic bend, there's also Republican influence at the local levels. And that's significant. That's no small thing. And so their party at the national level, you know, is representing them in such a way that their constituents are getting hurt by those state and local tax deductions. You know, they're going to, their constituents are going to look to them and say, hey, what the heck's going on? You know, this is not acceptable. We're getting hurt this way. And that further limits and reduces the power of the Republican Party in a state that, you know, where the Democratic Party has the upper hand. So in a lot of ways, it's really kind of contradictory. I agree with what was said before, that it really hurts a lot of the Republicans' base. And so that's why I think we're going to see a major fight. I don't know if they'll be able to push it through, because the base isn't just people that support the Republican Party. They come out and vote and they donate. And that's really significant. You know, poor folks or working class folks might benefit from certain, you know, government plans or whatever, but they typically are so disenfranchised that they don't vote or donate because they can't afford to. These people are not them. These people come out and vote. So we'll see how it goes.
John, the Republicans are on the horns of their own paradox that they've created. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's,
I mean,
right.
Because there's not just one Republican Party. There's several different important factions. Trump wants to lower the tax rate for rich people and for corporations. Then you have the Republican deficit hawks who are acting as if, you know, any government debt is an act against God.
Right.
In other words, it's not just an ideological piece. It's an article of faith that there has to be a balanced budget.
Right. And half of them have signed the Grover Norquist pledge to oppose any new taxes in any form.
Indeed. And so then if you lower the taxes for corporations and for the ultra rich, that means there's less money in the national budget, which means that either the national budget, the national government takes out additional loans from the banks and pays debt service to the banks to cover the deficit, or it cuts social programs, those are popular, or it takes the lost tax revenue from one sector and makes it up from another sector. So the transference in this case, thus, is the middle-class Republicans, semi-affluent, the top 20%, may be sharing a greater part of the burden to give the ultra-rich a tax break because the Republican deficit hawks won't accept a growing budget deficit.
Yeah.
And so
they can't
get out of that political dilemma.
You're exactly right. And, you know, we're really talking only about the House at this point. The Senate has its own views on what it wants to happen, and they are not at all identical to what the House is looking at doing.
Dave Lindorf, how important is housing to the U.S. economy? Because we have a situation, of course, the housing bubble, the overproduction of houses that could be sold at a profit in 2007, you know, sunk the economy, spiraled into a major financial crisis. And now if you have these kind of reductions of mortgage, the mortgage reduction, at least for homes greater than $500,000 in value or after $500,000, that will depress the housing market, it would seem. How big of a deal is housing?
It's a huge deal, but I'm not sure that the hit on the 500,000 plus houses is going to have that big an impact because the range of houses that get built is huge, and most of the building is under $500,000 houses. So I don't know as it would have that huge an impact. In certain places it will, you know, like southern Florida or, you know, where you're mostly building luxury houses, possibly. But, you know, most of these houses are not selling for $500,000. They're selling for, you know, maybe $300,000, $250,000, maybe even $400,000, but not a half a million. So, yeah, not that big. But, I would say that one of the classic illustrations of the point you made, that this is really benefiting rich people, is this really insane Republican focus on ending the estate tax. You know, they're now doubling it so that you can keep $22 million in assets without and pass it on to your heirs without any taxes. How many people does that affect? You know, most millionaires don't have $20 million in assets. They might have $10 million in assets, and those are already exempt from the estate tax. So why they have to worry about giving? And they want to get rid of it entirely so that people like Bill Gates can pass on his entire wealth to his family without any taxes. It's insane.
Daniel, your view on that?
Yeah, it's almost a return kind of to sort of lords and ladies of the feudal era, where you can just continue these generational wealth from generation to generation, where people just inherit vast sums of money and it's untouched and not provided to the society that, you know, helped create it. So I agree. And again, it appeals to such a tiny group of people. I think, though, the housing situation, you know, housing is incredibly significant and profitable. I think one thing we're not factoring in, or at least we haven't mentioned, is that the financial services industry and the real estate industry profit a great deal from these large home sales. And, you know, I'm in the Bay Area where the home prices are absolutely insane. And so a $500,000 house in most places is, you know, relatively extravagant. Here, you would have a very hard time getting a house for less than that. And so, here, and I imagine New York is a similar situation.
And Washington. It's definitely true here in Washington, D.C.
And Washington. Yeah. So that definitely impacts significant populations. And then also it cools down the profitability from those mortgage loans and those mortgage sales. And you're going to see powerful business interests, you know, like Wells Fargo or the banking industry and also the real estate industry fighting that. And they have deep pockets and a lot of influence. So we'll see how it goes, but they've definitely declared war on that part of the tax plan. And I would be very surprised if the Republicans were able to kind of push it through. I don't know if they have the cohesion needed to do that.
Dave, what's the time schedule here? I mean, we're coming up against the end of the year, the end of this congressional term, in fact. Can the Republicans pull this kind of thing together, given the really significant differences? And where you have, these are not simply ideological differences. I mean, you have different interest groups and different factions and different trends and within society who will be either helped or harmed here.
I think they're going to have trouble because they've got, first of all, they have a severely weakened president who can't really push anything because nobody really likes the guy in the Republican Party, you know, in the leadership. Then you have a weakened leadership because he's successfully undermined the leaders of both houses so that they're weak. They can't demand behavior from anybody in their caucus. So trying to push this through strong-arming people isn't going to work. And you do have all these different factions. So I think what they're hoping for is to be able to pass something in the Senate and something in the House and then go quietly into secret consultations in what they call reconciliation between the two bills, which then we'll come up with something that they have to bring back and get passed by both houses. And at that point, everybody who the theory of how this works is that then the people who voted for all these things to get the support of the moneyed people who they need, they can say, well, I voted for that. I put it in the bill. And then, you know, the reconciliation comes out and they have to vote up or down on it. And so that's what they're hoping for. Whether they can do it and get a vote in both houses to get it to reconciliation, I don't know.
And Daniel, just in a practical sense, when would it take effect then?
Then the tax plan would take effect starting the, I believe it's 2019, if I'm not mistaken. Trump said recently something about making it retroactive so that it would apply for 2017, which is kind of insane that suddenly the tax situation would change in a time that's already passed. I don't think that's actually going to happen. But then he wants to get this thing all wrapped up and all voted and everything before Christmas, which, I don't know, I think that's kind of a pipe dream given how contentious this is going
to
be.
And let's talk about also the politics again, go back to that and how it plays out. You have the Republican Party. I mean, let's just really try to help the audience understand what the dynamics are here. The Republican Party is, through its initiatives to basically sabotage the existing Affordable Care Act, driving up people's premiums. They're also depriving many people of health care because the way the system is being sabotaged at the moment through executive order. You also have now a situation where a lot of people are going to be harmed by the Republican tax bill, including their base, the middle class, relatively affluent people who might be supporting them. How does that help the Republican Party? How do these kind of things that hurt middle class people help Republicans? Go ahead. Anyway, what's your take on that?
I think that, you know, the defunding of federal funding that Trump kind of made an executive order on is so cruel because so much of the Republican platform has been that Obamacare is bad, but we're going to do something even better. We're going to create even better access to health care. And so we see these failed attempts at them trying to put some sort of health plan together that, of course, would leave millions without health care and were wildly unpopular. So they weren't able to do that. They weren't able to provide a superior alternative to Obamacare. And so what do? They simply defund it so that it fails. I think what they're hoping will happen is it'll fail, premiums will skyrocket, which is already happening. People will be so upset at it, and they'll blame Obamacare without seeing the kind of Republican hand behind it. So Obamacare will collapse, everyone will hate it, and then it'll get pushed out, and they'll put something in its place. I think that's their strategy at this point, because that's the only option they have. But it's really kind of, you know, disgusting to just simply defund these people and not offer any sort of alternative plan or superior plan, which is definitely what they promised. So I think they just hope to make people outraged at Obamacare, to hate Obamacare, and to blame it for its failure as opposed to the executive order to defund it.
And Dave Lindorf, in Kentucky, when surveys were done asking people how they felt about the Affordable Care Act, there was one sort of response. If they asked them, what do you think about Obamacare? They got another level. In other words, people who said they liked the Affordable Care Act also said, they hated Obamacare. Again, Kentucky is a state that almost tripled the number of people who are receiving health care because of expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. I want to go back, though, to the same question that Daniel responded to. How does this actually really help the Republicans? And perhaps it doesn't matter to the Republicans because of gerrymandering. I mean, the Republicans in aggregate lost to the Democrats by 5 million votes in aggregate for House of Representatives seats. They lost the presidential election by 3 million votes. But because of the Electoral College at the federal level and because of gerrymandering at the state level, they still retain a lock, not just on the White House, but a big majority in the House of Representatives. I mean, in other words, are they sort of inured from the actual impact of democracy?
Yes. I live in one of the most gerrymandered states in Pennsylvania, and my county, which is quite solidly Democratic, has a Republican congressman because his district looks like an octopus. I mean, it's incredible to look at it on a map. They just rigged it. The Republican legislature and Republican governor at the time rigged it so that, you know, he picks up every possible Republican little neighborhood by having these little arms from an octopus. But they do have a lock. But even so, I think that they're running a risk here, and I think this is why they're so desperate to pass a tax bill, that, you know, they're going to come into the election year in 2018, if they can't pass the tax bill this year, looking like a complete bunch of bozos who can't govern when they have a majority. And at that point, I think they could end up losing the Senate, which is only a couple of votes away from being Democrat, and even possibly the House if this kind of ineptness continues.
Daniel Sankey, the plan would slash the corporate tax rate, as we said, to 20% and create three new individual tax brackets of 12%, 25%, and 35%. It would maintain a 39.6% rate on top earners and boost the child tax credit to $1,600. I believe it also proposes a change in the standard deduction that individuals would be available to receive if they don't itemize their taxes. Can you talk about how this impacts different people? I mean, some of these numbers?
Yeah, so this is sort of what I talked about at the beginning, where they're kind of backing off a little bit and trying to sort of throw some bones, if you will, towards folks that aren't, you know, these mega rich corporation owners. I think the biggest, most significant one to point out, and the biggest deduction we're seeing, is the 35% to 20% for corporate tax rates. That's a huge cut. That's going to be trillions of dollars over the next decade is what it's estimated. You know, just to give you an idea, that's kind of the lowest it's been in decades and decades. You know, you think of like magnates like Ford back when Henry Ford was, you know, building up his company, they paid tax rates like 75-80%. And of course, that didn't hurt profitability. These companies are massive and wildly successful by any standards. Now we're dropping it down to 20%, which is minuscule. They are increasing tax benefits for children a little bit. They are trying to lower tax rates on middle income earners and keep the tax rates on the higher earners high. But by throwing these advantages to corporations and also through pass-through accounts, they're really continuing to benefit the very, very rich. So like pass-through accounts allow people to pass the money from the corporation that they own through to themselves as their income. And it's usually taxed as income tax. So it's taxed at a higher rate. The thing they're proposing is to allow those things to pass through and get taxed at the corporate rate, which, of course, as we know, is going to be lowered. So it kind of lowers the taxes for them to get paid out, and it's real an incentive for them to get paid through. Then I've also read there's some backpedaling on that, where they're trying to limit exactly how much they can pass through and what percentage of what they're passing through they can get that rate on. So there is a little backpedaling. But even as it stands, if it went into effect, you know, the way it's written right now today, it would be a huge win for corporations. They would get a tremendous windfall. So, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Dave Lindorf, just help the audience also understand the sort of the quid pro quo with the status of corporation. That gives you, the corporation, limited liability. So individuals, you know, don't really, you know, their risk is reduced, and in exchange, they're taxed. The taxes for American corporations in the 1950s, a time when the United States was, of course, the number one super dominant part of the world economy, the corporate tax rate at that time was 50%. And as Daniel said, those companies were still making profits hand over fist. Does lowering the tax rate, does it bring back the companies who are right now parking their corporations offshore, like Apple is an Irish company, so it doesn't have to pay American taxes? Will it bring those tax revenues back? One. And secondly, will a corporate tax reduction spur economic growth, which is another, of course, main argument of the Trump team?
Well, the answer to the first question is probably no, because most of these companies aren't paying even 20% corporate taxes. They're paying like almost, some of them are paying zero. And I mean, the real the real tax rate for American corporations is lower than it is for most other developed countries in the world, because they all have these write-offs that they get that allow them to escape paying their taxes. And also, as you point out, a lot of them are using internal pricing methods to push all their income abroad, and then they don't pay U.S. taxes at all. So I think, Daniel, I leave it to you as someone who's an analyst of this stuff, but to explain it further, but the U.S. corporate tax rate is for most large corporations largely a joke in terms of the rate, and it probably will continue to be.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So when we talk about the 20% rate, it is still a big payout to them for sure, because there are U.S. aspects of those businesses that do get taxed at those rates. But he's right. You know, when you say Apple's an Irish company, that's true. And they get, you know, incredible Irish tax rates. And actually, you can even see consternation in the EU where they're suing Apple for tax evasion, basically, and going after Google for similar things as well. You can see even over there, it's, you know, just absurd, the huge tax benefit they get from Ireland. So, yeah, the corporate tax rate here, you know, you'll hear the Republicans talk a lot about how it's highest in America because, you know, they'll point it to the 35%. But it's never that simple. It's much more complex when you compare it against other countries. The benefits and the loopholes and the special things we get show that we give out huge tax loopholes to them, especially offshore accounts and accounts abroad. So when we talk about, for example, Apple with money in Ireland, one of the things Trump had proposed previously, and this hasn't been talked about for a little while, was giving them a tax holiday as they repatriate their funds. So allowing them to bring their funds overseas back to the United States. And normally they would be taxed at that point, which is why they keep them overseas, of course. But he's saying, well, no, what we should do is give them a big tax break to encourage them to bring the funds home. But really, that's just kind of a legal fiction. You know, what does bringing the funds home mean? It's really just changing the status of the accounts and the entities that are holding the funds. It's not really bringing money into the United States or anything like that. And it's just a big tax break. Will this work? Well, look, we know about trickle-down economics. We saw it during the Reagan administration, and we know it doesn't work. When corporations are given the opportunity to take home a lot more of their pay due to tax breaks and other loopholes, it does not translate in them to passing it out to other people. Imagine if you got a raise, you wouldn't call your power company and tell them you'd like to pay them more, right? You're going to pay as little as you can.
I think we can all consensus on that. Unfortunately, Daniel, we're out of time. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst, and from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former DNC chair Donna Brazile published a shocking, for several reasons, article in Politico today slamming the Clinton campaign, Barack Obama, and her predecessor at the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and more. What's behind this surprise move? We're joined today from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. She's the director of politics and advocacy with Progressive Army, and host of the radio show The Way with Anoa. One of my favorite guests. Welcome back, Anoa.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that high praise coming from you, John.
Oh, no, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for joining us. This story is absolutely fascinating. It focuses almost solely on fundraising, and Donna Brazile does not pull any punches. She makes very solid accusations against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, against Hillary Clinton, against several high-level DNC officials who were affiliated with Clinton's super PACs. And then she talks a little at the end about apologizing to Bernie Sanders. What do you make of all this?
You know, some folks have said this is her mea culpa moment. I mean, she has a book that's coming out, I believe it's next week on the 7th, which will be really interesting actually to see. You know, I was one of the people who, you know, gave it my best and read what happened to actually see, you know, in full entirety to be able to give critique. I'm looking forward to reading Donna's book to actually see exactly the full extent of what she discusses from her experience in the election. But this piece, this is an excerpt, I believe, from the book, This was wild to wake up and read this morning, considering this specifically is talking about an aspect of, you know, what we saw, what we perceived as Bernie supporters, as those outside of the main, you know, Dem circles saw as what seemed to be one-sided control and favoritism to one candidate over the several others who actually initially were even in the race as of August 2015, when those initial victory fund agreements were reached. You know, several detractors have said this morning, well, for those who may not have read it already, I know a lot of people have read it, for those who may not be aware, basically this piece with Donna Brazile, it lays out the fact that there was the allegation of collusion or rigging in favor of Hillary Clinton during the 2016 primary season, in terms of the DNC and the way Debbie Wasserman Schultz did certain things, you know, to favor Hillary Clinton, if not directly tip the scale for Hillary Clinton when she was running with her primary contender as, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders. And Donna says that she made Bernie a promise, right? This is what she says. And Bernie doesn't really get into a lot of this squabbling. He's very matter of fact. He doesn't really do a lot of this stuff. So we'll see if he releases a statement or anything, you know, either today or, you know, going forward. He hasn't really said much about Hillary's book either. So it'll be interesting to what he says or what he weighs in on. But what's really interesting is when she starts going through, when she says that, when she takes over as interim chair and she starts asking questions about the money. Remember, everyone, she took over as interim chair leading into the general election, like basically during the middle of the DNC, right? The DNC is ongoing. That massive WikiLeaks dump happens, and we see a lot of documents, a lot of leaked documents that come out in the midst of the DNC that threw a lot more into question, including the fundraising. There were pieces by Matt Taibbi and other folks last May through July about the precarious nature of that Hillary Victory Fund and the DNC, that coordination they had in terms of funding and where the funds were actually going. There were some who outright, I think there was a political piece that outright claimed it was just basically a form of money laundering. Well, you know, we saw in October, ahead of the general election, October 2016, there were articles that came out where states asking directly for money for specific candidates, as well as even CBC members saying, you know, hey, we have these races, we need money. And so there were questions raised once again, the questions of the money and how, you know, the state parties were being funded and supported, considering I think it was 30 something states signed on to this agreement. So they would collect and raise money, and it was supposed to be split. There's supposed to be a split. But per what Donna, you know, lays out through her internal investigation, from what she says, that when she finally stumbled up, when she finally gets her hands on the agreement, and she says that people were dragging their feet. Right. There were decisions being made and people were dragging their feet, and she didn't really have all the information before she even agreed to become the interim chair. From what she discovered, the DNC was basically broke before the election cycle had started. And the agreement that basically that was come to through the DNC and Robbie Mook, you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, was that Hillary would pay off remaining debt from Obama's campaign. There was still debt from the 2012 from OFA, because they were on a slow, I guess they said they were on a slow or reduced schedule paying off their debt. And they were on schedule to not have paid off their debts, outstanding debts to the DNC until 2016. Meanwhile, you know, there's this whole election cycle that needs to be run. And if this is the case, and then she also alludes to the fact that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was not much of a fundraiser. So if other folks have been loaning the DNC to keep them afloat, and then the final, you know, guess nail in the coffin is that Hillary Clinton's campaign comes in basically as a loan, as a lender, or some might say even a loan shark, that they help the DNC stay on its feet. But from what Donna describes, the DNC was given an allowance, basically, in exchange for Hillary Clinton's campaign dictated internal operations, how things were done, strategy, spending, et cetera. So Hillary Clinton's campaign, in effect, was controlling the DNC, from what Donna is saying, since at least August 2015, if not sooner. Others would attest to the fact that the Clinton machine, which we've talked about this before on this show, that the Clinton machine is the most formidable political machine in modern political history and has an intrinsic, a really deep relationship with the state parties, with fundraising and financiers all up and down the food chain. And that relationship probably actually was much deeper, you know, sooner. But this was the first really clear sign that people can point to that her campaign was directly calling the shots. So, you know, for those who have been talking about it was unfair, it was unbalanced, it was rigged, you know, people can say Bernie wasn't a Democrat, whatever they want to say. But the point of the matter is that there were several people who were running for president, you know, as of last summer. And well, not last summer, but summer 2015, two summers ago. And the fact that the DNC, you know, through financial mechanisms, through the purse strings, was so controlled directly by one campaign, even though that victory fund was supposed to be only for whoever won. Like, control of the DNC generally goes to the winner of the primary.
That's so important because you're talking about 2015, where Hillary Clinton has taken control of an organization also known as the Democratic Party, which is broke, and she takes personal control of it and controls the finances and controls the ability to pay back debt. And it's all done prior to the primary season.
It's a violation of DNC policies.
It's a violation
of
DNC
rules. She's not the nominee at that point.
The DNC becomes her personal fiefdom. And then millions and millions of people, maybe tens of millions, go to the polls for primaries thinking that they're actually Democrats or they're registered as Democrats because they want to participate in the political process. They may be particularly excited because Bernie Sanders is somebody new on the scene and he says something different and he's bucking the establishment, and they vote and they think, okay, we have a chance of winning. But in fact, the entire system is fundamentally rigged, where not only Hillary Clinton, or not only is Bernie Sanders going against Hillary Clinton, he's going against the entire DNC machine, which privately, secretly, is actually completely in the back pocket of the Clintons.
Absolutely. And one of the things that Donna points out, and whether or not, so here's the thing too, right? I'm not some big advocate of Donna Brazile or anyone else, you know, within the Democratic Party. What I do recognize is whether this is, you know, her just trying to, you know, CYA or whatever this is still very, very important and huge. And she's still, there are a few people who have actually taking the time to publicly, even now with everything that they know, you know, taking the time to actually set the record straight on what did go wrong in the last cycle. Now, she is still someone that definitely feeds the flame on the Russia stuff. But at the same time, I can recognize that on this, you know, issue and this information, this is telling and this is huge. And this is something that many of us have thought. But when you're really reading what she's saying in terms of, excuse me, the dysfunction within the DNC, within the leadership structure that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was making, was allowed to make decisions, particularly financial decisions, without consulting the executive committee or others in leadership. And she, from what Donna says in that piece is that they did not find out until about the hacks until a few hours before the story. No,
a few minutes, she says.
Or she says it's a few minutes. This is also like the fact that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was allowed to run the party. I mean, granted, there were other problems before Debbie Wasserman Schultz even stepped in, you know, with Tim Kaine. Many of us often forget Tim Kaine preceded Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and some of that, you know, 1,000 seats lost happened under him as well.
I actually did forget that.
I did too. I forgot this. And then he became Hillary Clinton's running mate.
You're absolutely right.
But it's really interesting. And this is not conspiracy talk, people. This is like political strategy 101, right, folks? Like, if we're really trying to, quote unquote, win and steer the country back on track away from the Republicans, this race to the bottom that continues to happen with Republicans and trying to appeal to a certain conservative, you know, mindset is really antithetical to everything the Democratic Party claims it's about on paper, right? And then we see something like this. So not only do you have Hillary's campaign dictating well before, I mean, how can we trust the Democratic Party to have fair and free elections and process when they steer their own process internally to a particular outcome that suits particular individuals versus allowing the process to take its course?
Yeah, Anoa, let me just jump in real quick, because I also want to remind the audience that Donna Brazile, at the time of the revelations about the DNC, about the emails that were then revealed, whether they came from a leak or from a hack, we still don't know. She told people don't read these emails because they came, quote, from Russia, even though there's no proof that they came from Russia. I mean, and then she also, Donna Brazile, the same person, was secretly, as a CNN commentator, giving Hillary Clinton's campaign, this is before she was DNC chairperson, replacing Deborah Wasserman Schultz, she was giving the Clinton campaign the questions ahead of the debate. In other words, that's also part of the story. But, you know, I don't want people, as you're kind of saying, you're not a huge fan of Donna Brazile, even though these revelations and this commentary is so fundamentally important because it tells another part of the story.
I think what we need to do with everyone, whether they're our faves or people we don't really care for, is we need to look at the source of the information, right? We need to look at the information that's being provided and we need to weigh it accordingly and make decisions on next steps. I do think we need honest conversations about what happened in the 2016 election cycle, beginning with, you know, stuff that happened prior to 2015. You know, people need to let this Russia conversation investigation, I mean, it's taking so many different, you know, legs, and we've talked about this before too. That needs to run its course, but the fact remains that they were scrambling to neutralize what the perceived effect of that informational dump that summer could mean for the election. And it seems like Donna is tired. This is my reading. I don't know. But it seems like Donna is tired for carrying water and trying to, you know, carry the cross for the party. Because if anyone pays attention to social media, she gets a huge brunt of the ire of, you know, some Bernie supporters and others because of her perceived role or what we found out her role in terms of, you know, the email links, it leaks internally. And she basically got left to hang out to dry. Right. And so it just seems like there are these huger issues and people thought they were, you know, doing what was best for the party and for the win. Because in this piece, she shares an exchange she has with Bernie Sanders when she finally decides to call him, because it seems like she had a fear that, you know, this could blow the race for Hillary. There are so many different examples we have of people biting their tongue or holding their nose because they didn't want to mess it up because Trump is just so bad, right? Trump is just so bad. Nobody wants to blow it. And so in the exchange, in the article, you know, she says that she quotes Bernie Sanders as saying, you know, so what do you think? What are the polls saying as they're trying to decide whether or not, would use her language, they're going to kill the patient. She considers what happened to be a cancer, but she doesn't necessarily want to be the one to pull the plug because it does have such huge potential, you know, backlash considering who the opponent was at that time in the election cycle. And again, this conversation, from what she says, she came upon this information sometime right before the general election happened, right? So it took her several months, based on what she's saying, to actually get this information, even though she was then the interim DNC chair. And it seems like between her and Bernie, they decided to just not do anything about it. Again, from the information that she relays, that they decided not to do anything about it because at the end of the day, Trump needed to be defeated. And if we see, and that seems consistent with what Bernie Sanders has done since he conceded the primary.
Indeed, indeed. Fascinating discussion. Every day, something new, something really interesting about politics. It is wild. We've been joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. She is the Director of Politics and Advocacy with the Progressive Army, and she's the host of the radio show The Way with Anoa. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In a speech today in New York City, Attorney General Jeff Sessions exploited the grief caused by Tuesday's terrorist attack to push for mass surveillance and restrictions on travel and immigration. We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Chip Gibbons. He is policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. He has contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. Welcome back, Chip.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you so much for joining. I mean, the terrorist attack was awful. Innocent people just mowed down. I mean, truly disgusting. And yet, we can't think about this story without thinking about the fact that politicians are taking advantage, I would say taking advantage of this terrorist attack and the grief and anger people feel to implement policies that are not going to stop terrorist attacks, but are going to severely hurt immigrants and going to severely hurt democratic rights. Do you see it that way?
Yes, I absolutely see it that way. Very shortly after the attack, we already had Donald Trump on Twitter talking about he was going to do even more extreme vetting of immigrants, which is code for, you know, religious and racial profiling. John McCain and Lindsey Graham could not wait to announce that they wanted to have the individual who committed this crime held as an enemy combatant. It's interesting they didn't make a similar statement after a neo-Nazi ran over with a car in Charlottesville. But, you know, immediately after this attack, they're talking about holding the person as an enemy combatant. John McCain made one of the dumbest statements of all time to reporters, which he backtracked, which is that there are no Miranda rights for people who kill Americans. That is just ridiculous.
Chip, that is ridiculous. But just for our audience, which may not understand what the Miranda rights are and why this is another, well, one of many, many idiotic statements by John McCain, but help them understand.
So Miranda rights, if you ever watched one of the many, many, many police shows we are all inundated with at all time, I think that's the only thing on TV anymore is shows about cops. It's when they read you the rights that you have. They tell you the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. You have a right to if you can't afford one will be appointed for you. Anything you say can and will be used against you. They come from a 1960 Supreme Court case where an individual named Miranda, confessed to a crime without being aware of these rights. And the Supreme Court at the time ruled that the police had to make people aware of their rights before interrogating them. The Supreme Court has done a number of things to erode the strength of that decision in the preceding decades. And there's been, you know, every time there is a terrorist attack involving someone of Muslim origin or Muslim religious beliefs, you know, people like John McCain start saying, oh, let's not read Miranda rights to them. But, I mean, Miranda rights are read to criminal suspects every day. In theory, they're supposed to be. You know, the rights don't suddenly vanish just because you're made aware of them. I don't really understand the sticking point over Miranda, but the right has been obsessed with this since the very beginning. I mean, Richard Nixon campaigned in his reelection that he was going to appoint judges to help, you know, overturn Miranda.
Yeah, so, and we know, anyone who does pay attention, including even from some TV shows, that the police use all kinds of methods of intimidation and lies to get people to confess, even to crimes that they don't commit. So the right to remain silent, the right to have an attorney is a fundamentally important right. It mitigates but doesn't, you know, end. In fact, it just slightly mitigates the extreme power that the police have over people when they have people in custody.
The right to remain silent is incredibly important because we see a number of cases where people are investigated for crimes and they get nothing on them, but then they charge them with lying to the FBI, like the Trump official or the campaign advisor who's been charged. So, I mean, it's very important to be aware that you can just say nothing to the police. That's exactly what you should do.
Yeah, and that's George Papadopoulos. So, and your lie to a police agent could be an act of omission. Not simply that you're telling a complete fabrication. Let's go to some of the bigger issues here that Jeff Sessions is talking about. He said the president was right to issue his executive order, the travel ban, so-called, the attorney general said. He said the host countries targeted by the president did not properly screen people coming to America. They are countries that, quote, have failed to properly carry out their business. I mean, the individual who's alleged to have done this act in New York City is from Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan was a former Soviet republic. I don't believe any Uzbekis have in the past been associated with terrorist actions in the United States. Well, anyway, talk about the travel ban and what Sessions and how Trump are, what they're doing right now.
The travel ban is completely ridiculous. It comes from Trump's statement during the campaign that he was going to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. It's based on the premise that Muslims are somehow more prone to terrorism than other groups, which is absolutely not true. We've seen lots of terrorist attacks committed by non-Muslims. Most Muslims are, you know, peaceful people like everyone else. So it's singling out of them as part of this very racist agenda that Trump and Sessions have been touting. It also goes into their hardline xenophobic agenda. You know, immigrants are coming to our country. They don't respect our values. They're the threat. They're, you know, doing all these bad things to us when there's really no evidence to suggest that immigrants or Muslims or any of those groups as a whole are any more prone to violence than the rest of the population. I mean, like I mentioned before, we had a mass shooting in Las Vegas, you know, about a month ago. We had a similar attack with a vehicle in Charlottesville. I mean, none of those people were Muslim or immigrants. They carried out crimes. You know, most crimes are carried out by white men with histories of domestic violence before then. So it's just an excuse for going on these really ridiculous racist, white supremacist, xenophobic policies.
Yeah. In the case of Las Vegas, the shooter killed, I think, 58 people and hundreds were wounded. And Donald Trump went out of his way when the media was asking him, what are you going to do about this? Why do these mass shootings happen? He said it was inappropriate to discuss what to do or the bigger political or social issues, especially those related to or associated with guns. At a moment like this, we just had to think about the families, think about the tragedy. That was the line there. In the case of Charlottesville, as we know, we had that press conference after he did the written statement where he sort of spoke contemporaneously and said how there were very fine people on both sides, including the Nazis who had from whom the killer came. But they're not wasting any time to, you know, focus on the tragedy for the families in the case of New York. This is pure politics.
I mean, it exposes the blanket hypocrisy of these people. I mean, any sort of comment on what to do in the wake of a mass shooting, you know, and you're inundated with comments like, oh, why are you politicizing this tragedy? Don't you politicize this tragedy? And, you know, Trump and Sessions and all these other right-wing types cannot wait when they heard about the terrorist attack to start, you know, doing exactly that, politicizing it. I mean, Sessions in his speech today called for Section 702 of FISA to be renewed. Section 702 is the part of the FISA Amendments Act that authorizes the NSA surveillance programs that Edward Snowden exposed. It's sunsetting at the end of this year. It's also used by the, it's not supposed to collect information from U.S. persons, but they do. They call that quote unquote incidental collection because they don't mean to collect it. The NSA cannot tell you how many U.S. persons' data they collect every year, quote-unquote, incidentally. Congress has requested they give them that number. They've repeatedly backpedaled and now said it's impossible to know. So we have this program that's sucking up Americans' communications and other people's communications as well. And, you know, the NSA can't even tell you how many U.S. persons they're getting information from. And the FBI is allowed to go into those communications swept up and search them when they suspect a U.S. person of a crime, and they don't need a warrant for this. They call it a backdoor search because the NSA, quote-unquote, lawfully collected the information. They just incidentally got the U.S. person's information. The FBI does not need a warrant to go in and search through it when they're investigating U.S. persons in the U.S. for crimes. It's not just terrorism-related crimes. It's drug offenses, too. I believe somebody who was involved with the FISA court said that, you know, the FBI searches it like they're using Google. And Sessions has been very adamant that not only does he want Section 702 renewed, he's against any sort of warrant requirement for these FBI searches. And he used that in his speech today saying, oh, we need to renew 702, although I have no idea how in any way Section 702 is related to the terrorist attack in New York. I mean, they certainly can't. And he's also going on, they have all these cell phones and encrypted devices they can't open up. So we need to get further into your electronic communications, which is the other big thing that Sessions and the FBI really want to do. They're against, you know, you having an encrypted cell phone. They want to get in at all your messages. So,
yeah, we're talking with Chip Gibbons. Chip, the Constitution of the United States of America, the highest law of the land, has something called the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, meaning probable cause that a crime has been committed. But what Section 702 allows the NSA to do is to collect everyone's information, search our and seize our communications, and keep it for the government without probable cause. It's a complete violation of the Fourth Amendment. It makes it moot.
I mean, there are a number of things that have made the Fourth Amendment moot over the preceding decades, but that is one of the worst. I mean, the NSA does not need a warrant under Section 702 to collect this data from, quote unquote, you know, foreign persons outside of the, people they believe to be reasonably believed to be outside of the U.S. and not U.S. persons. But they're getting all of this incidental data. They're getting U.S. persons, U.S.-based communications. And then because, oh, we collected them incidentally without a warrant, we're now allowed to search them without a warrant if we're the FBI or the DEA. I mean, it's a completely absurd thing. No reasonable person can find that to be, you know, a good faith understanding of the Fourth Amendment. It's just another way in which our rights are being eviscerated by these, you know, security state that wants into all of our information.
Final question. Saipov, the individual from Uzbekistan who's alleged to have carried out the terrorist attack in New York, he entered the United States legally in 2010 under a program called the Diversity Visa Lottery. Sessions today said Congress should abolish that diversity lottery visa program in exchange for a merit-based system. Will this keep America safe? Will this make Americans safer? We have about 90 seconds left.
No, it will not keep America safe. I mean, I'm not an expert on the visa-based lottery system, but neither is Donald Trump or Jeff Sessions, and that has not prevented them from commenting on it. But no, there's no evidence to support the notion that people coming in on the diversity lottery-based system are any more prone to criminal acts than anyone else. I mean, most crimes are committed by people who are, you know, born here, and it's just more xenophobia, it's just more scapegoating. Like, let's blame this extraordinarily marginalized population that we can and whip up hatred and frenzy against.
Yeah, and originally the diversity visa program was designed to help primarily people coming from Ireland in the 1980s. Anyway, we're almost out of time. Chip Gibbons, in New York City, a lot of people have already complained about the NYPD, their cooperation with the CIA, the infiltration of mosques, the surveillance of Muslims. This is a major issue right now, and it seems to me that with Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions as the leadership, people have to do something. They have to mobilize. What can they do? We have about 30 seconds left.
One of the best things you can do is you can get your local law enforcement to either cut off ties with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force or change their memorandum of understanding that they have to follow local or state privacy and civil liberties laws. Almost every state and locality has better protections for civil liberties than the FBI does. And when your local police join the FBI Terrorism Task Force, and it's largely staffed by local police, they sign memorandums of understanding saying they'll follow the FBI guidelines over their local ones. You can get your city council or your state legislator to pass a law saying no.
We're out of time. And your website, real quick, Chip.
Rightsanddissent.org.
Okay, that was Chip Gibbons. He is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.